listening to the Taylor Swift Fan Club podcast, the podcast about all the things that matter and a lot of things that don't. With me, Tim Burden.
And me, Michael Pattinson.
So, welcome back to the Taylor Swift Fan Club podcast. We're back in the starting pen for another ascent of Alpe d'Huez, all 21 corners. Michael, welcome back.
Hello, Tim. Thanks for the welcome. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
All right, thank you very much, yeah.
So I really enjoyed last week's podcast. It gave me a lot to think about, our discussion around joy, around happiness. And I don't know about you, but I think the thing that stayed with me while we do a few matters arising before we head off up the Alp, the thing that really stayed with me was that distinction between happiness and joy. And I think I realised that I'd much rather be joyful than happy.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you. And I've got another question as well, I suppose, about this, which is I'm 45. I keep getting this wrong with 46. And don't think it's amazing that you can have a chat about something and then suddenly you realise there's a different perspective to you'd ever thought about it?
Yeah.
Which in itself is a bit joyful. But I would much rather be joyful than happy. I agree with that.
There's a song which I listened to again after our discussion by an American singer called Carrie Rodriguez. And I remember hearing her play a gig a few years ago, and she had a song called Sad Joy. And I think, because she kind of talked about it before she played it. So she'd written this song, I think, about someone that she knew who was terminally ill, and the tension, I suppose, between sadness and joy, and seeing the look on this person's face at a time of great happiness, but also great sadness as well, and how those things can be experienced at the same time, which is really amazing.
Do you know what? It reminded me of a story that when it's weird listening to your own voice, but I listened back to the podcast because that's the only way you can know if you're getting any better or you need to change anything. But I remembered this story about how I went to one of my best mates' dad's funeral, and it was 15, 16 years ago. Mm. And I realised sort of towards the end of it, I'd had a brilliant time. So I said to his mum, I said, I feel a bit bad here, but I've had an amazing time. You know, we've hung out, I've met loads of people I haven't seen before, met some people I've never met in my life. We shared some stories. It's brilliant. And she was like, yeah, that's what it's supposed to be like. You're supposed to be sad, but you're not supposed to be totally sad. You're supposed to be happy as well.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
So that feels like quite a deep start, even though we've not actually left the pen yet. We better
it is a bit deep.
Get ready, start spinning the legs because the clock's counting down and it's time to head up the Alp.
So as is traditional, Tim, I've got a warm-up quiz.
Oh, okay.
Are you ready for it?
I am ready.
So it's a build on episode 5. Was it episode 5 last one?
Last week was episode 5.
Episode 5. That feels like a bit of a milestone in itself. But it's this. I'd like you to rank in horizontal speed the three things. So it's how fast do they go horizontally?
Okay.
And it's this. It's the hummingbird, the golden eagle, who makes an appearance again week two, and Filippo Ganna in the 2021 World Championship time trial.
Right. So
again,
okay.
I'd like you to put these in order. Hummingbird, golden eagle, and Filippo Ganna.
Okay. Now, Filippo Ganna in a time trial, presumably a flat time trial.
Yes.
He's going to be going pretty fast, isn't he? Is he going to be going as fast as a hummingbird? Hummingbirds are famously the smallest birds in the world, perhaps?
Let's just say one of the smallest
birds.
I know what the UK smallest bird is, if that's helpful.
The UK smallest bird, is that the goldcrest?
I think I knew what they were, but I'm going to have to Google it. I always thought it was the wren. But now I think you're right.
The only reason I know is that I found a goldcrest in some distress outside my house a few years ago, and I kind of rescued it, and it was very, very tiny, And someone said to me, oh, yeah, that's the smallest bird.
I'm going to look it up. So according to Google, the smallest UK bird is the wren. No, it's not. It's the goldcrest. You're absolutely right. I'm going to have to hang on a minute. But here, this is exciting. It says, is what UK bird is smaller than a wren? There is only one bird smaller than the wren, and that's the goldcrest. Oh, hang on a minute. This is getting tense. According to some more people on the internet, it's either. So they think that the goldcrest is the second smallest bird. Anyway, doesn't matter, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Let's get back to it.
Are you thinking maybe you might need to ask for your money back from the young ornithologists?
I think so. I'm going to send them the badge back in disgust. This is disgrace. Yeah. I'm sorry. You did I get it wrong or did they teach me wrong? Anyway,
I think they taught you wrong.
Yeah, they did.
Anyway, right. I think that the hummingbird is fastest. I think it's going to be really quick over a short distance. Obviously, it couldn't sustain the length of time that Felipe managed.
Ganna, yeah.
I'm going to put the hummingbird as fastest.
Yep.
I'm going to put the golden eagle as the slowest, and I'm going to put Felipe Ganna in the middle.
Wow. Exciting. So,
I'm not feeling confident.
So to double your money, I'm trying not to give anything away with my voice.
Okay.
Would you like to have a guess at Filippo Ganna's speed?
Okay. Is this his average speed?
Average speed in average the 2021, I should say, World Cycling Time Trial Championships.
Do you know what the distance
which
was?
Which he won. The distance was some distance.
Okay. This is really hard. I don't know how fast they go. I'm trying to think how fast I go, and then I want to add some quite a lot of speed to it.
Yeah, that's how I would say.
So an ordinary person like me might be able to average 25 miles an hour in a time trial.
Correct, yeah.
So let's say that he was able to average 33 miles an hour.
Do you know what? This is unbelievable. So I'm going to give you the speeds first.
Okay.
So fastest, Tim said, hummingbird. Our survey said, correct. Hummingbird is the fastest.
Thank you.
Second fastest, Tim said, second fastest? Yes, Tim said, Filippo Ganna. Also correct.
Get in.
Which means the golden eagle is the slowest. So, in other words, Filippo Ganna is faster than a golden eagle.
That's brilliant, isn't it? I'd love to be faster than a golden eagle.
Me too. I think that deserves a little tweet to Filippo, by the way.
Yeah, just tell him well done.
So that's pretty exciting. So you've got 3 points, which is your greatest haul yet.
It's highest so
three
far, points. Isn't it?
Highest so far. So for double your money, you have to be within 1 mile per hour of Filippo Ganna's actual speed. And you said, did you say 35 miles an hour?
I said 33.
Oh, you said 33 miles an hour. He did 34 miles an hour.
Oh.
So, yeah.
But I still get a point. You said I had to be within one.
You double it. So you got 6 points.
6 points.
Yeah.
Imagine going 34 miles an hour for however long.
I can't imagine it. I just can't imagine it. It makes me so upset. I remember the first time that Alex Dowsett did, like, beat the UK time trial record. I was deep in training for time trial, and he'd done it in like 31 miles an hour, and I was thinking, I don't understand how he's done it that fast. No. Don't understand. No. So anyway, so yeah, Filippo Ganna, all-round general legend, but not as fast as a hummingbird.
It's funny you should mention Alex Dowsett, because he was in my Zwift Racing League race on Tuesday night.
Was he?
I raced against him, yes.
I have raced against him in real life, so how did you do compared to me in real life?
Well, I did quite badly in that race. I came 60-somethingth out of 80.
Yeah.
So I just assumed that he was way up the field and had maybe won. But Alex Dowsett was a DNF in that race.
Wow. So in other words, you beat Alex Dowsett?
In a way, yeah.
No, not in a way. That's CV worthy. You beat Alex Tassett.
I did better than him in that race, certainly. Yeah. I'm quite pleased with that.
I did the Red Bull 24-hour hot lap thing, which Alex Tassett also went to. And I saw him. Who was he riding for at the time? Katusha, I think. Did he used to ride for Katusha? Anyway, his kit was purple. And I saw his sort of scarlety, purpley kit for about 11 seconds. And never saw it again. So he did better than me in that, I would think. Is that warm-up done? Are we on the Alp yet?
I think so, yeah. It was a little brag as well, wasn't it, that I
it was a little brag, yeah.
Finish better than Alex Dowsett in a Zwift race. But before we get too braggy, I think that it is important that we get ourselves onto Vent Corner and get things off our chest. So anything that we're feeling we need to vent about this week, what have you got?
I'm selling something this week.
Okay.
So I did what everybody does, is I put a for sale post on Facebook Marketplace. And here's my vent, is why do people comment on it, unhelpfully comment on it? So someone even said that, oh, ho, 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 have you accidentally put a one in front of that? And I'm like, what would bring somebody to basically say, look at something, go, oh, that, I think that's more expensive than I would expect it to be. I know, I'm going to helpfully comment. Why would somebody do that? So, I've been trying not to get irritated by all these stupid messages on my for sale post.
Huh. Yeah, I can see that's quite annoying. There are a few things that annoy me on those selling sites. It annoys me when people sell bikes and they don't know how to sell bikes.
What do you mean? Go on.
So they'll be selling a bike and there'll be maybe one or two pictures where you can't see the important bits. So you can't see what the group set is. You can't really see any of the components. They don't say what size it is. They don't say anything of the spec. They'll just say road bike.
Racing bike, usually, if you know.
Racer. Good condition. And they'll put things like tyres need pumping up. Well, pump the tyres up then.
Do you ever buy these bikes? I have once bought a bike that's exactly as you've described.
And how did that turn out?
But I think it could have easily have turned out not well. But, like, so I don't understand why you wouldn't clean your bike and pump the tyres up and take some decent photos, because it's going to be worth half what it's worth, isn't it?
And you're just not going to get anyone interested. So, like, if I'm looking at lots of ads and there are some which tell me exactly what it is, and there are some which tell me nothing about it, like, I can't be bothered to send this person a message and say, can you tell me what size this is? Can you tell me what the group set is? I'm pretty sure they don't know what that means anyway. Yeah. Can you tell me what wheels it's got on it? You know, all that sort of thing. So, frustrating. Another thing that your vent reminds me of is people who comment on questions that have been asked on, like, Amazon. You know, when people ask questions, they'll say, like, "Will, is this compatible with such and such?" "How heavy is it?" or whatever. And there are people who give answers where they just say, "I don't know." what are you doing? Like, how is that helpful to anyone? Like, literally, they'll say, "I don't know, mate. Sorry."
I don't know how that's useful. I have this sort of game with a friend of mine where, you know, the sort of village Facebook things. I like commenting on the village Facebook things in a way that I think's funny, but actually, like, probably isn't. So here's one that I did, but it was actually cycling sales. So it said, brand new boxed S-Works Evade, size large. Don't ask if it's available, if it's advertised as available, and can post to UK only.
Okay.
So I replied to this saying, is it available, and can you post outside the UK? which I think is a bit of a service to grumpy people. Do you think that's a bit mean?
Did you get a reply?
No, they never reply. The other one I did recently, which was the local village, somebody said, "Hi, I'm a small photographer and I want to take photos of the church. Does anyone know open and closing times?" And I replied, "Just let yourself in through the letterbox, mate." But he replied to that with a little smiley face.
So, well, that's good. Yeah. Is your village Facebook group just a cesspool of racism and people complaining about dog poo in the same way that mine is?
There's a bit. And so they're actually my favourite ones replying to, usually quite obscure. I'm just going through all my replies here. Do you remember when there was no fuel and everybody was complaining and it got all Brexity got all like, you know, why are people? Ooh? And then I replied and I said, "I got fuel in the central Milton Keynes, the Esso near the escape last night. Once I got to the front of the queue, I got quite emotional and started filling up." So I thought this lightened the mood. Would you like to know how many people on this post thought this was hilarious?
I would, yeah.
There was like 300 things. It was one person thought that was hilarious.
Did you get some angry faces on those?
I got a few angry faces, but you know, it's a service. But I interrupted you. What were you saying about your dog poo and bins?
I play a little game where I count the number of comments before you get to the point where someone says they need to have their hands chopped off. Or like the regular post about dog poo having been not cleaned up, which probably turns up every sort of 6 weeks. Someone posts about this situation, and again, how many posts do you get down the comments before someone says, "Oh, they want it smeared in their faces. It can make it makes kids go blind or something like this," and it's just hideous. Well, my event is that the weather's rubbish, isn't it? We've had Storm Dudley and then Storm Eunice and then Storm Franklin is on the way at time of recording. And I feel, do you remember in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, how it was always winter but never Christmas? Well, like now it feels like it's always winter. We've had Christmas and it's still always winter. And I know that in just about a week's time, it's going to be officially the start of spring. But I just don't quite believe it. I find it really hard to actually believe that at some point in the future, there are going to be really nice sunny days when we can go out in shorts and cycle and have a nice time and need to wear sun cream and all that sort of thing. So that's my vent. Rubbish weather. So the weather's been rubbish outdoors. I wonder what the weather's been like in Watopia. It always looks nice, doesn't it?
It does always look nice.
Should we go over to James on the 3R weather and travel desk for an update?
Great idea.
Here's the latest on the roads. Snow and ice is affecting the road conditions at high level. Plenty of care needed if you're heading up into the mountains today. In Watopia, though, it's moving well around Ocean Boulevard just now, but a server crash has caused some traffic to be diverted. Doesn't seem like it's causing much delay just at the moment. A landslide on the KOM bypass has partially blocked the road, traffic managing to squeeze by there. We've also got some reports coming in of a serious fire breaking out in the volcano area. No more details on that just now, but it might be worth avoiding the area for the time being. Heavy rain in London means there are patches of standing water, looking particularly bad on the Embankment and Constitution Hill. Staying in London, we've also had some reports of riders being pushed wide on Whitehall and scraping the side of the Cenotaph, so a bit of caution needed there if you're out with a large group today. In Innsbruck, there's been a breakdown just at the top of the leg snapper. I know the feeling. You may find some restrictions in place while everything is recovered. James Lowe, Zwift Traffic Control.
Well, I think we've officially arrived at Bragg Corner.
Yeah.
Got any brags this week?
I emailed Jeremy Powers and he replied, which is sort of a better hit rate than Billy Bragg. But yeah, Jeremy Powers replied.
You're going to need to tell me who Jeremy Powers is.
So Jeremy Powers, he does the commentary on Eurosport / GCN's cyclocross races. He is the over-enthusiastic American guy. And I sort of love him because he's enthusiastic all the time. So I sent him a little message because it's the end of the season yesterday, officially last race of the season. So I sent him a little message saying, "Thanks for commentating. I've enjoyed it. And I gave him a little bit of genuine structured feedback, not expecting him to reply anything.
Okay.
And he replied and said, like, yeah, thanks, man.
Did he write it all in capitals?
No. He wrote, imagine for a moment that you were four times national champion and won, I think he won like 90 UCI races or something like that.
Wow.
He was pretty handy. And probably still is. But yeah, so I expected him to reply like, what are you talking about, you idiot? And he went like, thanks, man.
Oh, that's nice.
I thought it was really nice.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, that's my brag.
Great. Are you going to do something with that email? Are you going to like print it out or?
Should I get it framed?
Otherwise, it's just like in 5 years' time, it's going to be somewhere in the depths of your inbox.
Yeah. Because I got one from Chris Boardman as well some time ago. He asked my opinion on one of his bikes, so I told him.
Chris Boardman retweeted my tweet and said that I was phenomenal once.
What had you done to... For, that's considering he was like winner of the yellow jersey, gold medalist. Wasn't he like kilo champion, held some world records as well? And he thought something you did was... Did you just say phenomenal?
Phenomenal was the word that he used.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And what was it?
I cycled from Paris to Brest and back on my Boardman bike. And I, on completing that, 1,220-something kilometres, I tweeted at him a picture of my Boardman bike and I said, hello, Chris Boardman, I just cycled the 1,220 kilometres from Paris to Brest and back on my Boardman bike. It did you proud. He retweeted it and said, phenomenal, well done.
Nice. So this has added a second layer to the fact that I think he takes his name being on bikes quite seriously. He's very interested in my feedback about racing because I used to race a Boardman cyclocross bike. He was very interested in my feedback. So, yeah. What a ledge.
What a ledge. I've got another little brag.
Go on.
My official brag. That was just a follow-on brag.
A warm-up brag. Yeah.
Yeah. I got an FTP increase.
Wow.
I got a phenomenal FTP increase the other day.
So when you went to, I'd love to, but first of all, I'd like to. So you did. How did you do the FTP test? Ramp test during a race? How did it come out?
So I'd set my FTP a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Doing an FTP test, one of the standard Zwift FTP tests. Yeah. For people listening who don't know what that means, FTP, functional threshold power, it's meant to be the amount of watts that you can sustain for an hour, basically.
Yeah.
Then, on Tuesday of this week just gone, in the Zwift Racing League race, I got an FTP increase at the end of it. This was the race which was on the Watopia Climber's Gambit course, which finishes on the epic KOM reverse. So you've got a long, sustained climb, which is...
Roughly 20 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah, roughly 20 minutes. It's just kind of just right for... stretching your FTP.
So what was it then? Spill the beans. How much? What was
Would you like to guess how many watts my FTP has gone up by?
So here's my guess. Every time I get an FTP increase, it's like 2 watts. So I'm going to say 3 watts.
It went up by 2 watts.
Oh, I should have gone for two.
2 watts in 2 weeks. The training is obviously paying off.
So if you do a watt a week, in 2 years, you'll be world time trial champion.
That's the trajectory, isn't it? So
yeah, it's got to be. That's how it works, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, well done anyway. Congrats from me.
Yeah, thank you.
So was that mostly earned by doing big miles on Zwift?
No, not really. A bit of a mixture of things, really. So doing some just long, steady miles. I've been Zwifting on the rollers, which has been interesting, falling off from time to time, but that's been quite good. I've been doing some custom workouts, and as I told you before, I've been lifting some weights a little bit too.
Wow. Do you know who I'm always super inspired by every time? I warm up for the morning, our 3 hour morning ride, which is usually 6 o'clock in the morning. I see in the little counter one of our 3 hour riders, Kat Allen, who's always done about 70 kilometers before I've even woken up. And I always find that super amazing. There are these people that just do these mammoth just miles.
Bang out the miles day after day. Well, it's funny you should say that because I caught up with Kat this week and we had a chat because she's hit, in recent weeks, she's hit a massive Zwift milestone. And so I chatted to her about it. Let's listen.
Right. So I'm very pleased to be joined today by 3R's very own Catherine Allen. Kat, welcome to the Taylor Zwift fan club.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we've invited you on today because you hit a very big milestone quite recently. Tell us what that was.
So, yes, at the end of January this year, I hit 100,000 Zwift miles. And I did that on the 4th anniversary of joining Zwift.
100,000 Zwift miles. Now, there are a couple of reasons why I like this. Number one, it's an unbelievable amount of Zwift miles. I don't think I know anyone else who has done quite so many. But number two, I love the fact that you timed it to coincide with your 4-year anniversary, because clearly you share my appreciation for round numbers and symmetry and that kind of thing.
I do, yeah. And to be honest, it was always a bit of a might not make it on that date. And it was, as long as I can get it around that date, it's great. But in the last sort of 4 weeks, I was sitting with my Excel spreadsheet and thinking, I actually possibly might make this. And I did. I made it with about 1 minute to spare before I needed to go off to work.
Brilliant. It landed very, very well. And this actually wasn't the first time that you'd hit a milestone with excellent timing, was it? Because, again, remind us about the previous one.
So that was the 100,000 kilometres, which was, I managed to make that on my birthday in, oh, crikey, that was November 2020. Yes, losing track of time. Yeah.
Brilliant. Now, a little bit of maths off the top of my head tells me that 100,000 miles in 4 years is an average of 25,000 miles a year, which is more than 2,000 miles a month, which is something like 500 miles a week for 4 years. So tell me what a normal Zwift day looks like, because you're doing a significant distance every day.
Yeah. So I guess, I think basically since lockdown, I've moved into a place where I've now got sort of a weekly goal of 900 to 1,000 kilometres a week. Okay. I don't do miles. I used to.
Sure.
So a normal Zwift day on a working day means getting up around 4 and then being on the bike, hopefully before 4:30, and sticking on the bike till about 8. That roughly will get me 120 to 130 kilometres. And then a couple of lunch breaks, I might jump on again, just for some headspace and if it's not nice enough to go outside. And then Saturdays tend to be the day where I try to go a little bit longer, try and get an Imperial Sentry in, or maybe if I'm lucky and got enough time, up to 200 kilometres. And then Sunday is my rest day where I just aim to get 100 kilometres in.
just a nice easy 100 kilometres. I'm really interested in this in a couple of different ways. So presumably, what you're doing is all very steady, consistent riding. You're not doing lots of high-intensity VO2 max stuff, are you?
No, I'd say 80% is grey-blue graph at the end of the day. But I will always make sure I'm obviously doing a Volt or an Octane or go hard in a Tour or something, because I need to keep a little bit of sharpness in there.
Sure.
So I also want to keep myself as Cat B mixed, so I've got to keep that level of watts and watts per kilo. You can't look at Zwift power and not see my green bee.
Take me back a bit. What's the journey been to where you are now? What's brought you to Zwift and brought you to using Zwift in the way that you do?
A few things. I've always been sporty and started running in my early 30s. Having abused my body quite a lot in the 20s, I decided I needed to, be fit. So I'd started running and did 11 marathons. And I'm a sort of person that basically throws myself quite wholeheartedly into things. Basically, if I did 50K 1 week, then the next week I want to do 51 or more. Mm-hmm. Running is a cruel mistress that doesn't really let you overtrain, if you like. Sure. I would get injured if I tried to do too much. And I used to find that incredibly frustrating. And then I adopted a child in 2014. And that meant that running was going to be very limited in how I could get out and do it. So I bought a spin bike and shoved it in my bedroom. Mm-hmm. And I just used to spin if I couldn't run. And eventually I got quite bored with that and I kept getting running injuries. So after my last marathon in 2017, I had terrible high hamstring tendonitis, which went on for a few years, which was when I bought my Tacx Vortex. And a friend said, why don't you try Zwift? And I logged in and thought, this looks superbly weird. I have no interest in this whatsoever. So I didn't ride. I just looked and thought, strange. But then I think it was January 2018, I'd gone out thinking I'd overcome my run injury, and I hadn't. It was awful. I limped home and thought, right, I need to find another outlet for this because running is just not happening. Mm. So I did a Zwift, and I absolutely loved it. I remember that very first ride. It was about 15 kilometres around London and thought, this is brilliant. And therein began the journey.
You never look back. 100,000 miles later, here exactly. we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, as well as doing your 900 to 1,000K a week, you know, you've already mentioned that you helped to lead 3R Volt and 3R Octane. What does being part of Team 3R mean to you?
It means so much to me. I remember meeting Deb Stockley about 3 or 4 months after I'd started Zwifting. We kept turning up at the same rides and started chatting. Mm-hmm. I think Debs and I joined 3R at the same time. What a family it is. You know, I've made so many wonderful friends. When I had some bad times, flowers arrived. And yeah, I just absolutely love the team. And then when I started leading, that took it to a whole nother level for me. It's weird. I don't feel like this is a virtual platform anymore. It literally doesn't occur to me that it's virtual. These are people just not sitting in the same room as me. It's fabulous, honestly. And I can't explain it to people who don't do Zwift. I think they think I'm crazy. But you, as someone who Zwifts and part of 3R, will totally get where I'm coming from.
It has got to the point where you do just forget that you're interacting with people online. You forget that you might have never met them in person. No, I've never met you in person, but I feel like I've known you for ages. But there we go. Now, I remember just thinking about leading 3R morning rides. Forever etched in my memory will be a ride that you led on Octane up the Von Top course, which for me was, I think, was the hardest morning ride I've ever done, but actually was the most fun morning ride that I've ever done. And I think it was partly because the level of challenge, for me at least, was just right on that particular day. It really did sort of take me to my limit, but kind of just the correct amount. Do you enjoy really making the big lads on a Wednesday morning suffer on Octane?
I do. But
I don't include myself in the big lads category, to be
fair. I'm definitely not, which is why all of my leads are uphill, because, you know, it becomes a bit more of an equal playing field uphill when it's what, 3 kilo. But I do. I absolutely love jumping on Discord on a Wednesday morning. And then Ollie and Brett and Chris and everyone else and Benny, all waiting for some brutality, as they call it. I absolutely love it, but I'm not convinced it's that brutal for them, because I'm always having to shout at them and tell them to stop putting out 4.5 when I said 4. Volt is wonderful. I've done it for nearly 4 years. Octane, I've been doing for a year, which it's a different type of group, but they're both beautiful and I love them. I love leading both of them.
Yeah, for the benefit of those who are listening who don't know what we're talking about in terms of the morning ride, so Team 3R has three different rides that all happen at 6 o'clock in the morning UK time during the week. So at three different levels. So Spark is our Cat D ride, Volt is our Cat C ride, and Octane is the Cat B one. And it is brilliant fun, isn't it? It's a fantastic way to start the day.
It so is, yes, definitely.
Have you got any ambitions, things that you're looking forward to now you've hit 100,000 miles?
So I think doing the 12-hour ride in December, which a lot of people be like, oh, that must be easy for Kat, it's not necessarily true, because I had not done longer than 6 hours before that, so that was quite a jump up. But I walked away from that and thought, that's how I felt after I did my first marathon. I had a taste for in that sort of longer endurance. So my next, and having watched you and Carolyn bash out your V Everest, that's on my list now.
The cards, good.
It is. I'm going to go and help a friend on Sunday do a double V Everest. So I'm going to go for a couple of laps and then start thinking about when I can find some time to do it, because my home life is, being a single parent means finding windows of 12 hours where I'm not cooking, cleaning, supervising little me is quite challenging.
Sure. Well, you'll have to come and join us on Mountain Madness on a Saturday morning and visit the various corners of Mountain Madness. You mentioned about being a single parent and finding it hard to fit the times in and how that made running difficult. This is why Zwift works quite well, isn't it? Because actually, you haven't really got the option to sort of go out for great big long days out in the countryside. And you live in London as well, don't you? So it's not very easy in that sense.
Yes, exactly. I have to say, I find it slightly annoying when people on Zwift are like, oh, why don't you go outside IRL? IRL is the only thing that counts. It's like, well, I disagree. I've got people I know who are partially sighted, so IRL isn't an option.
No.
And for me, I don't have the option to just walk out for 6 hours on a Sunday. And I wouldn't choose to do that either, because, you know, I don't get a lot of time with my daughter. She's at that age where she doesn't really want to spend a huge amount of time with me. So I'll take the wins that I get.
Yeah.
So yeah, for me, fitting it in before I start work Monday to Friday. And then I also get up at stupid o'clock at the weekend as well, so that I'm off the bike before, you know, most people have even probably surfaced from bed.
Yeah.
So yeah, Zwift is a lifesaver in so many ways, you know, for being able to exercise at a time that fits in with family commitments and work. But also, I have to say, for me, it has been a mental wellness support that I couldn't have done without in the last probably couple of years.
And that's multifaceted, isn't it? Because it's about your physical well-being. There's the community that we're part of. Just the benefits to your mental health in terms of what the physical exercise does. And it's hard to put a price on that, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if you chat to people, which I've done recently, we've talked about lockdown and everything and how Zwift has helped so many people survive what may have, you know, pushed some people over the edge with their mental well-being.
Okay, well, it's been so good to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us on the Taylor Zwift Fan Club.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So I guess that brings us to Charity Corner. And the charity, of course, that we've been chatting about the most over recent weeks has been the RNLI, Royal National Lifeboat Institute. They've had a busy time of it recently.
They have had a busy time. And did you see one of their roofs blew off as well?
I did see that, yeah.
So they're out saving people and a roof blew off. So I think now is a worthy time to dig deep and send them a quid.
Yeah, absolutely. They were saving people who had gone swimming in the sea during a massive storm, haven't they?
Why would you do that?
I don't know.
I was trying to say that without judgment, but it sounds madness.
It does. I think that it's okay to be a bit judgy of people who had put their lives and put other people's lives at risk, because, you know, the RNLI going out to save those people was not without risk to the lifeboat people, was it?
No.
So I'm happy to, well, I try not to judge people. I'm happy to judge those swimmers. Yeah.
So I think we can temper it slightly by saying, don't do it again.
Yeah, learn your lesson.
You've learned your lesson. Don't do it again.
Say sorry and make a donation to the RNLI. Yeah.
Yes. So make a donation. Say sorry and as part of your sorryness.
My mum always used to say, sorry means I won't do it again.
I like that a lot. Sorry means I won't do it again.
Yeah, I don't think it does mean that, but it's what she used to say.
I like the sort of thought behind it. As in, I like the point it's trying to make, because it's not always right, is it?
No.
But my favourite RNLI story, which was from some years ago, but they kept rescuing this man in a yacht.
Okay.
Did you remember this story?
I think you need to tell me a bit more before.
He kept rescuing a man in a yacht who was navigating using a slightly out-of-date AA road atlas, UK road atlas, and he kept getting lost.
At sea?
Yes, at sea. So he did not learn his lesson and kept doing it. I don't know what he did in the end, but the RNLI had to rescue him repeatedly because he was lost floundering around probably still in UK waters, but trying to navigate using his AA roadmap.
Using his roadmap. So yeah, RNLI have had a busy old time and doing a fine job, I'm sure. So do send them some money if you've got a moment. But I think that takes us on to Joy Corner. And my bit of joy is very similar to my joy from last week, which was that I got out on my bike again for possibly only the second time in months.
Nice.
Which was good. I managed to find a little gap between storms. So we had Storm Dudley. Then there was like a day when it was dry.
Yeah.
And I seized the moment and I got out and I rode for a couple of hours into the wind and then for an hour and a half back because I was able to go much faster on the way home.
Nice.
And yeah, had a nice time.
I feel a bit jealous because I have not managed to find a gap in storms. And my ride this morning was undone by storm. Storm Felicity? What are we up to now? What's there? Frank?
Franklin. Yes.
No, it was interrupted by that, which is a shame. So do you know what I've had to kind of resort to for my joy corner, my joy this week?
What's that?
The Winter Olympics.
I think that sounds pretty joyful to me.
There's been so much to like. I'm just going to pick a couple.
What have been the highlights?
Well, so what I've really liked is the loads of stories about people who've kind of stuck at it and kind of make it work. There are young people because... You know, youth is wasted on the young, which I know is a cliche, but it's true. Mm. But there's been a few instances where people have stuck at it and it's finally come going good at the end. I think my favourite of them being is the ski cross was won by the combined age, two people, a man and a woman, combined age of 76. So the guy was 40.
That's great.
And basically, it seems to be in these kind of alpine active sports, once you're over 30, you're too knackered to do anything. So that, sure. Yeah, that was amazing. But the bit that I've been really like was curling. And it made me think back to one of our previous episodes where I said something like, I don't like the word hope because it implies a lack of planning. And you've got a plan for success, so I don't like hope. Mm. And I was watching the curling and it occurred to me that as they're lining up, and they're sort of just pushing it off and they give it the little twist, the little curl. Just as it leaves the hand on its way to its destination, and to do that, it's got like a whole career and hours and hours of training. That's hope, because you hope what you had planned in your mind is actually going to happen. Yeah. And there's that joyous, and it made me think about Zwift racing and actually racing in general. Which is you've kind of got two options. You can sit there and just kind of wait for things to happen, or you can make things happen for yourself and you can launch off the front. And every time I launch off the front, I have this future in mind where it's going to stick and I'm going to stay out and it's going to be amazing and I'm going to win. So yeah, that's what I thought. So it made me think, should we put some more out there? Should we like go for more long shots?
And there's lots here, isn't it? This has neatly brought us to Philosophy Corner to think about, I guess, the philosophy of hope. I love that that thought about the curlers and that moment of letting the stone go. Because one of the things that I noticed about the curlers when they, at that point, when they release the stone, is they are in that flow state that we talked about last time, aren't they? It's absolute concentration. And you can see that they are totally... in the zone with what they're doing. I love as well how they've got to literally let it go and they've got to trust. And once they've let it go, there's not an awful lot they can do. They do the whole shouting thing, saying, curl, 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 and they're getting their teammates have to
brush it
the brushing to make it work. But once they've released it, that's it, isn't it? And there's something about relinquishing control.
Yeah.
There, which is quite interesting.
Do you know what? It's really interesting because I sort of see that as a joyful thing. You know, just as you let it go, it's just full of like hope and optimism.
It's pure potential.
It's pure potential. And it turns out that this is one of the things that makes humans, it's the big evolutionary advantage we've got, apparently, which is this ability to have prospection, which is, in other words, you can see all of these different futures. Because it sounds obvious, but unless I could see the future where I'm crowned world cyclocross champion or crowned Zwift eSport champion, why would I even bother trying to smash it off the front?
How often does it succeed? Because I've noticed you go off the front on morning rides at the mini race.
All the time.
Many a time.
It's what I do. Here's what I think. Hope and optimism is a term which seems to be used interchangeably and therefore doesn't really have a definition. So park that for a moment. But there seem to be two kinds of optimism. The first one is dispositional optimism. What that basically means is, do you think everything's going to turn out all right? Now, I think I'm quite high in dispositional optimism, but I've got some questions. If you want to see where you sit on the optimism, dispositional optimism scale, which obviously listeners at home can also play along to. Do you want to hear them?
Yes, I do.
So you have to imagine a scale in your head, and one side of the scale is, that's very much like me, and on the other side of the scale, that's not at all like me. And obviously bits in between, a bit like me, etc. So here's the first question. And by the way, I've stolen these from somebody else who I'm sure I will remember towards the end of this, but these are actual psychological questions in a big study. So anyway, in uncertain times, I usually expect the best. Very like you or not at all like you?
That's very like
Next me. Question. I'm always optimistic about the future.
Yes. Can I say I'm mostly optimistic about it? Am I meant to give you a 1 to 10?
For speed, I didn't write all the gradients in between, just these two. But you can say it's mostly like you. Mostly like you.
Mostly, yes.
And the last question, which I've chosen at random from the longer list, is I rarely count on good things happening to me.
No, I do count on good things happening to me.
So you and I share high dispositional optimism, which is where we think that things are going to be all right, which I think is sort of why I do that launchy off the front when I'm drifting. And actually, that's how I race as well. I'm high in that dispositional. This is going to be great.
This is interesting because I'm not at all surprised by the answers to your questions. I am aware that I am an optimist kind of by nature. I don't race like that in Zwift. I think I am more cautious.
Mm.
And so, I don't know, maybe I should try a few more attacks. Whenever I have done that sort of thing, they've often spectacularly failed. I don't know, I remember a race a few months ago when I kind of accidentally found myself off the front.
Yeah.
I think I dropped a power up and it sort of pushed me further forward than I thought it would. And so I found myself in the position of like having to have a go, and actually I pulled it off. I didn't win the whole race, but I succeeded in getting over the KOM banner first, which I was quite pleased with. So maybe I need to learn from that.
This is an amazing segue. It's like we planned it, and we generally haven't planned it, but there is another kind of optimism, which is called agentic optimism, or you hear it called as agentic hope. So dispositional optimism seems to have this, exactly what you were talking about, it seems to have this positive cycle. People high in it seem to have good stuff happen to them. So in your sense, high in dispositional, I find myself off the front, and that's when agentic hope or agentic optimism takes over. And what that is about is, can you do something to shape your future? Do I have agency over what my future looked like? So if I've got some more questions about this to see where you and I would, so and listeners at home can play along with this as well. So again, strongly agree to strongly disagree scale with whatever grade it's in between. Question number one.
Sure.
I have the power to make my future better.
Agree. Strongly agree.
Strongly agree. I see many paths to achieve my goal.
Strongly agree.
Strongly agree. The paths to my important goals are free of obstacles.
No, I don't agree with that.
Do you strongly, what am I scale? Strongly disagree?
There are obstacles.
Yeah.
So yes, I strongly disagree with that.
Yeah. I picked that one out especially because I always think there are obstacles. I think they're get overable, which I know isn't English, but you know what I mean. So I was thinking about this in the context of all the things that we've been talking about before. So I have the power to make my future better. Well, that's why we train, isn't it? That's why you race. It's why you get get your 1, your 2 watts FTP increase. There are many paths to achieving your goal. That's what we've been talking about. I'm trying to take the path more cheerful than I've taken before. But you could also take the highly trained. You could do, there's loads of paths you can do to it. But there are always obstacles, aren't there? So illness and family and storms and things like that. But yeah, so I am also high in agentic optimism. I think that I can make changes. And it turns out that although the two are different, everything's going to be fine, versus I have some power over my future, it's one of the big changes in human history, apparently, which is this increase in agentic hope.
Because we've essentially got more agency than we ever have done.
Correct. We have more ability. So previously, so I think Greek mythology, which I know is something you know much more about than I do, they're all about basically this is what's happened and there's nothing you can do. You're basically a bystander. And the stories and everything that's happened are much more agentic. And that's why, that's what all of these, all of the recent history improvements in people's lives have been driven by this increase in agentic optimism.
Yeah. It's really interesting, isn't it? And I think we have to be conscious that we in the West are in a much more privileged position in that sense. So I work part-time for an international development charity, and I'm very conscious that actually part of the work that we do is not simply about helping to make people less poor. Yeah. It's about giving people agency.
Yeah.
It's about giving people control over their own lives. So it's about giving women and girls access to education. Yeah. It's about all that kind of thing so that actually people have choices. And that is about providing hope, isn't
Agency
it?
Isn't a given. It's kind of you expect what your surroundings are. And I think it was in Mexico. I'm going to say Mexico. There was this storyline where one of the female, strong female characters basically stood up to her husband that was treating her really badly. And that had a bigger impact into how other women in that situation who watched it felt what they could do. And you suddenly found people standing up more for their rights. And I seem to remember that the person started their own sewing business. Sounds a bit random. And then suddenly that sales of sewing machines went up by like 10,000%, which was people just going, oh, I can have my own agency. Yeah. But you're right, it's quite, I don't want to trivialise it because we're talking about Swifter bike racing, but it's such an important thing, feeling that you have agency.
Again, it's about why I campaign on issues of injustice. So again, this is connected with the work that I do and anyone who has in any sense been a campaigner, whether you've, I don't know, signed a petition or been on a demonstration or whether you've done anything, whether you've taken action for a better world, it's because you believe that a better world could be possible and can be possible. I believe that to be a campaigner is to be an optimist.
Yeah.
Because you have to be convinced that actually we can do something about this. And the fact that global poverty is lower, significantly lower than it was 20 years ago. It's been hit hard by COVID and you know, the last 2 years, I think for the first time recently it's kind of gone in the wrong direction. But the fact that we have been able to do something about global poverty should be taken as an encouragement.
Yeah.
It reminds me as well of the title of Barack Obama's book. Can you remember what it's called?
No, I can't.
So Barack Obama's book is called The Audacity of Hope. Which brings us back to that brilliant word that we've spoken about before, audacity, as well. That there's something audacious about hope, about believing that things could be better.
What you just said about things being awful and getting better at the same time links back to what we talked about in the last podcast, which is richness isn't the opposite of poverty. You can have both at the same time. Things can be getting generally much better, but at the same time be truly awful. But the bit that I used to love about Barack, which is can I call him Barack? Are we on first name terms?
I think he would be fine with that.
Was there's especially in big bureaucracies, there's a sense that you've got to like do things properly first time. But whenever anybody came into his office and said, I've got this idea, it's not perfect, but it's going to make things a bit better. He just used to say, better is good. And it's that sense that it can't be perfect, but better is good. You've got to go in that direction. And the other thing, just, I love what you're talking about that. Again, that's agentic optimism, because the other thing that you tend to find from it is it's cumulative. Every time you go for something, you learn for something. And I'm not trying to trivialize it, but in kind of a think about my Zwift racing, my 1 minute power is going to get better from doing all of those trials off the front. If you're campaigning for something, you've got to try, because it's, you chip away at it inch by inch. And every time you do it, you learn something. So it seems to be that the thing that really is effective about agentic optimism is the fact that it makes you into a trier. And the other thing that, I know this is really obvious, but it's how you get followers. I would think Obama, if he was a misery guts, people wouldn't want to follow him if he was Eeyore all the time.
No.
And at the same time, if he wasn't painfully optimistic in Pollyanna, people wouldn't follow him either. He's got to get that right sense of, I'm dispositionally optimistic. In other words, I think generally everything's going to be okay, but I think we have agency about how that happens.
Yeah. Can I throw something in to perhaps just, I don't know if it's being devil's advocate, but just maybe to make the case for on the other side for a moment, because I've chatted with Tracy about this, and because I think I am personality type wise, I'm an optimist. She would happily acknowledge that she's not, and her inclination is to expect the worst. And her reasoning is to say that, well, if you expect the worst, you're not going to be disappointed. You're only going to be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go about life thinking that everything's going to be great, you're probably going to be disappointed. And I understand, well, I understand her reasoning. I can't be like that because that's just simply not how I'm built.
Yeah.
But I kind of take the point.
But it seems to be that there's a sense, at least, of causality between both expecting the worst and expecting the best.
Sure.
So, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy is a real thing. Expect the worst, guess what, it's going to happen. Yeah. There's loads of I've found an interesting study about this that was talking about people who take high levels of like life insurance and medical insurance and things like that, and they tend to use they tend to use them and need them.
Right.
Which sounds bizarre. But but people who have less medical and life insurance tend to need them less. There's something, and whether you can say that's causal or correlational is difficult to say, but it seems to be that if you expect the worst, you tend to get it.
Is there, are we being perhaps a little bit unkind on people who, like I said before, it's part of how they're built, that it's all very well for you and I to sit here as people whose personality is naturally inclined towards optimism, but other people it isn't. So at some point, we will do an episode about the Enneagram. So Enneagram personality type 6 is intrinsically wary of the world. For an Enneagram 6, the world is a scary place.
Yeah.
It's dangerous, and we need to be careful. Because if we don't take care, then we're going to come to harm. I'm not that Enneagram type, and I'm sure that you're not either, even though we haven't got you to take the test yet. For those people, that's just how they're made.
Yeah.
And it's all very well you and I as a couple of optimists going on about how great it is to be hopeful.
Yeah. And this is something that I've thought about a lot, which is that it's fair to say that you tend to gravitate around a certain type. And it's also fair to say that there are people in situations who, for hope isn't much use. So, I don't know, if you're deep in the caste system, for instance, having agentic optimism isn't going to get you very far.
Sure.
But I think it is possible to change and to learn and become a different person. And although that isn't at all where I started talking about, I think if you take the amazing thing that is cycling, you have nothing to lose trying to get off the front a bit more. You've got nothing to lose from that. And you might learn a lot. It's something that I find myself saying all the time is very often you can't think your way into a new way of thinking. I can't anyway. You've just got to act your way into a new way of thinking. You've got to try some ways out. So That would be all I would say to that.
The only other thought I had about hope was that from a theological perspective, hope has a slightly different meaning. So hope in a Christian context means something more like assurance. And it's a little closer to certainty. So when hope is talked about in that religious context, it's about saying we have this hope. And you could use it almost interchangeably as saying I have this assurance, this confidence, I can have this almost certainty. And it's often sort of linked to talking about heaven, I guess. And when you speak about the hope of an afterlife, it's something that you can have confidence in rather than just saying, oh, I hope this will happen.
Yeah.
It's about saying, I feel assured of this.
That's interesting. And without trying to expand it too much, so if you talk about hope and you talk about optimism and you talk about hope being something which you're assured of happening, that's not that different from faith, I suppose, is it?
No, I don't think so. I think they are very similar. Yeah.
It's kind of a mix between dispositional and agentic hope, I suppose, which is it's a mix of the two where you're expecting the future that you see when the curling stone leaves your hand to actually happen.
I don't know. Eve Muirhead, who's just won the gold medal with her team. If I think about the way that her team will have had to put their trust in her, and she will have inspired them, and they will have felt such confidence in her that they will have found hope in her. And that's perhaps a little bit closer to this kind of theological hope that I'm talking about, that it's more like, yes, put your trust in me and you can be assured that we'll succeed.
That's interesting. So it's a bit about leadership. Did you watch the British men playing the Americans? Because I think what happened there is what you were talking about. I think that the skip and the players started to lose faith in each other. Because he started to criticise the other player's shots.
Okay.
He started to lose a sense that this was my perception watching and listening to them, was he started to lose that hope that he'd choose the right shot and that when he'd chosen the right shot, it would go in the way that he expected. It sort of all seemed to fall apart, whereas the British men started to all sort of quietly coalesce and have confidence. That's really interesting, though.
Really interesting, isn't that? I think that brings us to Desert Island Discwheels. Have we had a Desert Island Discwheel submission?
We've had a written contribution, which I was going to read out to you.
Oh, please do.
So it's from Gareth Bancroft, who, as you may have remembered, was the originator of the idea for Desert Island Discwheels. So I bothered him a little bit and said, you can't come up with the idea and not submit your own. So Gareth has sent us in his Desert Island Discwheel. And it is Dancing on the Ceiling by Lionel Richie.
Love it.
which I loved immediately. So I'm going to read. I'm going to pretend to be Gareth now. Are you ready?
Yeah.
He said, whenever I hear this one, I can't help but laugh as it reminds me of the 50th VE Day celebrations. Myself and my friends, Storky, Nipper and Big Kev, had set out on an all-day around midday, intending to keep it steady as we planned on hitting Bradford's worst nightclubs later that night. Just 3 hours later, an unquantifiable amount of tequila, and I was dancing on the ceiling of the pub, being held up by those three. For that moment in time, I was Lionel Richie. anyway, so that's it. That's Gareth's Desert Island brilliant. Discwheel. He is
fantastic.
Lionel Richie.
I think that. All that's left to do is for you to tell us a joke.
I've been really struggling for jokes, but I had to use Gareth Bancroft and his Lionel Richie. So my neighbours always play Lionel Richie very loudly, and I usually don't mind, but yesterday it was all night long.
Very good.
It's not very good, is it?
Do you know what? It's not bad. It's not bad at all.
I tell you what, I'll try harder next week. I'll pay more attention next week. But This has been lovely, Tim. I've really enjoyed this, as always.
Great. All right, then. See you next time.
See you later. See you next time. Bye.
See ya. Bye.